Sometimes an action by one person can have a profound and wonderful effect on the life of another. Today, we'll hear the stories of four people whose lives were changed by others. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we'll hear about a supportive and inventive mother, an inspiring artist, an organ donor, and we'll find out how an act of love sustained one woman during her darkest hour.
I was thinking, how am I going to go back to school this year? When will I be walking and running again? What's out there? And who is going to want to be with me through all of this?
Join our conversation. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're going to hear stories about people who have changed the lives of others for the better. It might have been through an act of kindness, through long-term loving support, or it may have happened purely by chance. We're not taking calls this hour, but please, we'd love to hear your stories. So post them on our Facebook page at Iowa Public Radio. My first guest today is Dan Knight. He's a pianist and composer who lives in Iowa City, but has traveled the world as a performer, and he is here with me today. And Dan, the story you're going to tell us today goes back a long way to when you were a very small child.
I was 5 years old, so it was 54 years ago. How's that for math? And I had just begun to take piano lessons, and my teacher gave me this assignment. She said,
Your music teacher.
My music teacher, my piano teacher, she said, listen to all the music you can, and if it's piano, try to figure out how many counts are in a measure and what kind of note gets one count.
So it's probably clapping along to music and trying to figure out what the structure is.
Yeah, and there was a particular song on this children's show, and there was this beautiful thing where there were white gloves and a black background, and the music went bum 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 bum. And the piano went, da-da. And I kept counting, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, or 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And I couldn't find it in any of my books.
It just didn't make sense. It drove me crazy,
you know, because everything was 2 counts in a measure, 4 counts in a measure, 3 counts in a measure, 6 counts in a measure. But there was never 5. There was never 7. And I kept thinking I was counting wrong. So I counted over and over and over and over and over again.
And this sounds like something that became quite a bit of an obsession for you.
Oh, I was obsessed. Are you kidding? So I talked with my mother and I said, why don't we send a note to this TV show?
This was Captain Kangaroo.
Yes, this is Captain Kangaroo. So he said, why don't we send a note to this TV show? Why don't we send a note to Captain and ask what it is? So my mother got the address to CBS from our local TV station. And she said, you know, I think this is going to be more meaningful if you write this letter. So I sat down with my best crayons and a nice piece of paper. And with her help, I wrote this little letter. You know, dear Captain Kangaroo, I'm 5 years old. I'm taking piano lessons. I watch your show every day. I hear the song, you know, blah, 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 with the white gloves and a black background, and I can't figure it out. What is this song? You know, please tell me. Yours sincerely, Danny Knight, right? So I send this off, and my mother says to me, she said, you know, Captain Kangaroo gets thousands of letters every week from children like you. So if you don't hear back from him, don't feel badly about him. And I said, Mom, I know he's going to write me. I know he will. I know he will. I know he will.
How could Captain Kangaroo not write
to me, you know? So I have an important question here, you know? So finally, after a month, maybe 6 weeks or so, it's into summer, and I'm kind of forgotten about it a little bit. I see the mailman, and he looks at me and says, Danny, we have a letter that has your name on it. And I went, I looked, I ran over to him, and sure enough, there was the logo, the Captain Kangaroo logo, his face with the keys and all that kind of stuff on the upper left-hand corner, the return address. And sure enough, I recognized my name. So I thought, this is it. So what happens? I go in, my mother opens the letter for me, she reads it, and it says pretty much, you know, dear Danny, thank you for your beautiful letter. I love hearing from viewers like you who are inquisitive and interesting. And he said, the song you inquire about is from the time further out, album by this gentleman, and he said it's called Unsquare Dance. I grabbed a hold of my mother and I said, "See, look, here it is. Here's that album right here." So we ordered it, and I proceeded to play the grooves off the thing as only a 5-year-old could.
This was the music of the great Dave Brubeck.
This was him.
And here is a man who played with time like almost no other musician. That's why you were so stumped.
I was completely stumped. So when I figured out it was Dave Brubeck and it was time further out and it was a song called Unsquare Dance, I ran down to my teacher's house and she was teaching a lesson. So I blew right past her husband who was sitting on the front porch, right through her front door, right into her studio. And I said, "Mrs. Mather, there can be 7 counts in a major. There's 7 counts in a major. I know it." And she's like, "This is illegitimate music. You will never amount to anything. I want you to be a Steinway artist. You will never be a Steinway artist if you do this. This is terrible. You must never listen to it." And of course, to a 5-year-old, this is kind of like, "Oh, send me out. I'm ready for this," you know.
So that didn't hurt you? That
didn't... Oh, wait, turn me the opposite direction. I said, "I have to know about this. If Mrs. Mather doesn't like it, maybe there's something there." You know, so sure enough, I mean, and then just a couple weeks later, Dave Brubeck was Time Magazine's Man of the Year. So I said, you know, he couldn't be too bad if he's doing this. So she taught me ear training and sight singing and theory, along with learning how to play the piano. So I just took my sight singing and my ear training and my ability to write notes and to take dictation as she was having me do. And I sat down in front of the recording player, and sat down in front of our high five and listened to Brubeck. And wrote it down.
You transcribed his
and
music.
I transcribed it. And I didn't know it was difficult to do because I was 5 years old. I shouldn't be able to, you know, but I did. So that's just what I did.
So it was Dave Brubeck that made you a jazz musician.
It was. It was. He set me off on this journey that was just most amazing.
But Mrs. Mather, she got her way, too, because you became a Steinway artist.
Yes, you know, and of course I did it. I did it, of course, the perfect day and night way. It's like completely around the back door. But I did. And she used to call me her little Paderewski. I was a little monster on the piano.
When you became a Steinway artist, you, of course, started traveling and performing. And you wound up in New York City at the same time as Dave Brubeck?
I did. And it broke my heart at first because I had looked for an opportunity to say thank you in person. I didn't want to write him a letter. I just wanted to say thank you for this beautiful journey upon which you have sent me. And he was going to be the person of the year, the honoree at the Jazz Times Convention. I think it was in 1998. And the convention was going on at the same time I had been asked to go and do something for the Steinway people. And I'd committed to that.
So
I couldn't get out of it, you know. So I couldn't be at the convention, and I couldn't go to the concert. I couldn't go to this little evening honoring Dave Brubeck, and it broke my heart because I had to be in New York. I had to be at Steinway Hall, and I had to go do these things for these people. So I got done with my little mission at Steinway about 10:30 or so in the evening, and then caught a cab over to the hotel where the convention was happening. I got there about 11 o'clock or a quarter after, and I was just disconsolate. I mean, absolutely devastated because I had missed my chance. So I'm walking down the hall in this hotel, and Lee Mergner, the managing editor of Jazz Times Magazine, comes out, and he looks at me and goes, Dan. I said, "Yeah, Lee." He's like, "Did you see the concert tonight?" And I said, "No, I didn't get to go. I had to be in New York. I had to be at Steinway Hall." He's like, "Do you want to meet Dave Brubeck?" I said, "Are you kidding? Are you, you know, who do I have to, you know, what do I have to do?" So then he's like, "Well, he's right over here. Come on, we'll just take you over." And then I look over, and Dave and Iola Brubeck are sitting at this table. And Lee Mergner says to me, "Come on, Dan, it's like I want to introduce you to Dave." So I sat down, and I walked over, and I told him this story about Captain Kangaroo and about my search for him and the search for this music and this beautiful journey that this whole thing set me on. And about halfway through, he stood up, he had tears in his eyes, and he wrapped his arms around me. And it was the most perfect moment of my life to then, one of them anyway, probably the most perfect musical moment, the chance to say thank you, that you mattered to me. And you gave me something to find, and when I found it, it was a beautiful thing. And It was just wonderful. So we sat down and he had me sit with the family and we hung out for like the whole rest of the night. And I said, this is not my life. isn't this wonderful? But I thought it made me want to do that more. But to go and say thank you to people who have no idea what they've done for me.
And you did say thank you to Captain Kangaroo after that,
yes,
right?
Yes, you know, I did. I said, there's another half to this whole process. So I got a hold of the people at CBS because I knew Dr. Billy Taylor there, and he was still doing CBS Sunday morning. So I said, Dr. Taylor, can you find something out for me? I need to get a hold of Captain Kangaroo. Can you find Bob Keeshan's address? He's like, I'll have it for you tomorrow. So he said, call me tomorrow, and I'll have it for you. So I called him. I got his address, and I put a little box together of things. And I said, you know, Captain Kangaroo, you or somebody in your staff answered my letter. And because you answered my letter, it set me off on this beautiful life which I live now. And I just had to say thanks. And I had to tell Captain especially that I still remembered the magic words, please and thank you. You know, so that was how he closed every one of his shows. So I said, okay, I'm saying thank you now after all these years. So I sent him CDs that I had and a copy of my joining the Steinway artist roster, and I got a beautiful response from him later.
And that was very shortly before he died?
It was just shortly before he passed away. So I said, okay, I need to start doing this.
Well, Dan, thank you for telling us your story today.
Thank you.
Pianist and composer Dan Knight. This hour, we're listening to stories from people who have had their lives changed in a dramatic and positive way by someone else. In a few minutes, we'll hear the story of an organ donor. We'll hear about a supportive and very creative mother. And later, a woman will tell us how an act of love sustained her at the most difficult time of her life and for many, many times after that as well. And this, of course, is Unsquare Dance by the late, great Dave Brubeck, who died just a few weeks ago at the age of 91. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. For the last couple of weeks, we've been asking people to get in touch with us to share their stories of someone who impacted their life in a powerful and positive way. This hour, we're sharing some of those stories with you. You can also hear more of these stories today on River to River with Ben Kiefer at noon. My next guest is Jennifer Confirst of Des Moines. She's the communications manager at Iowa Public Television, and her life was forever changed by a generous stranger. Hello, Jen. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
And this story begins a few years ago with your vision. You had always had good vision, right?
Yes, absolutely. And a few years ago, I started noticing that I had blurry vision in the morning and at night. And I wasn't really sure what that was about. And, you know, after it continued to happen more and more, I had my eyes checked for glasses, didn't need them, and finally went to an ophthalmologist who told me about the reason that my eyes were like that.
And what was happening?
I have something called Fuchs dystrophy. It's a genetic condition that essentially I've learned a lot about eyes. The endothelial cells in your cornea die which fills your eyes with water. They pump the water out of your eye and the cells die, so your eyes fill with water. So it was kind of like in the morning and at night. It was that moment right before tears fall. That's kind of what it looked like in the morning and at night. I had really haloed cars and lights, and it was just kind of scary because I was driving my kids often in the morning and at night and didn't really like the uncertainty of it.
So if this condition is left untreated, what happens?
Eventually, a person will not be able to see. They will live every day, all day, with that cloudiness, that vision problem. And so it continually gets worse. It starts out in the morning at night, and then it gets worse as the day goes on, the longer you have it, because you have fewer cells. So there are fewer cells to pump water out. So it's in the morning and at night, that's when your eyes are either tired or just waking up, and so that's when all the water's there.
When you learned that you had this condition, what was your response?
Well, I first called family because I said, if it's genetic, why is this the first time hearing of it? And, of course, that's when the stories came out that, oh, yes, that's why I've had a cornea transplant. Oh, yes, did you know that I had this problem? And so I was able to get some information from my aunt who had had it not too long ago. And I learned a little bit and really felt like, well, good, I don't have to worry about this for 25 or 30 years.
But that wasn't the case for you.
Sadly, no. I went to the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, and they looked at my eye and said, you know, normally we don't see people. I'm 39 almost. And normally we don't see people here your age, but all of the cells in my eye died in the center first. Whether they normally die, kind of poke it out all over your lining. Mine all died in the middle, which meant that my field of vision was affected first.
And was being affected rapidly.
That's right.
You already mentioned a cornea transplant. Is that the only treatment?
Yes. It's the only treatment. It's the only way to fix it. The endothelial cells don't recreate themselves. And so they're just going to keep dying, and it's not going to get better. So it was just really a matter of when and not if. And so one of the concerns was, since I'm young, everyone's endothelial cells will die throughout the course of their lives. It just happens very slowly, and it's just sort of part of the aging process. But since mine was happening so rapidly, we wanted to make sure that I would have a nice, I don't know how to say it other than a nice strong cornea that would last me a good long while. And so they needed to really make sure that the surgery was successful with a really good transplant.
In other words, they were waiting for a young, strong person?
Yeah, and, you know, you don't want that. And it's such a hard thing to have happen because, you know, you feel like, well, some people get transplants, and of course, because their lives are being saved, or they're, you know, they're able to, you know, have a new heart or new kidney because of a very generous donor. And isn't that so wonderful? And I felt like, but aren't I just being sort of selfish? It's just my sight. Until, of course, I talked with other people who've had it, and I remembered my fear of driving at night with my kids, and I thought, well, they're only 12 and 10. I've got a lot more to go, and I want to be able to see when they're driving so I can backseat drive a lot. So I needed to make sure that I had good vision. So though it was hard, it really was the only way to fix it and would fulfill the quality of life that I think that I still deserve at this age.
How long did you wait on the transplant list?
The beauty of it is there just is not a long wait because the cornea, a cornea, of course, everyone has two, and so there are twice as many. And donor corneas can be donated when other organs can't. Often people with cancer or things like that can still donate corneas if they're organ donors because of the way it's separate from the rest of the bloodstream. So it's really it wasn't a long wait. And, you know, of course, like with anything, when I got to Iowa City, I wasn't sure if it would happen that day. And, of course, sadly and happily, it did. Sadly for a family, happily for me. And it was just very mixed emotions.
What do you know about the person whose cornea you received?
Only that it was a woman and she was 41. And I know that she must have died shortly around the time I had the surgery because they don't last. And so, you know, I don't know much more about her than that. The Lion's Eye Bank does allow you to write a letter to the donor's family, thanking them and telling them the impact that their gift had on your life. And then if they're interested in writing you back, they can. So I wrote a letter through the eye bank and just told them about the things that I was able to do with my kids and the experiences I was able to have, and sent it that way. And it really, I hope that they appreciated that and felt that in their time of loss that they had given something back.
This woman was 41 years old, so very close to your own age.
Yes, and you know, that was, of course, good from a medical standpoint because then it would last as long as I do, is the hope. But it was very hard to think about, you know, she could be a mom like me. She could, you know, be doing any, her kids could do anything to ride with a mom, whether she has good vision or not in the car. And so it was very hard. But I thought a lot about how obviously her family and she thought it was important enough to find some good out of this loss. And so that warmed my heart and helped me feel a little better about the very, you know, mixed feelings I have. I know I keep saying that, but I really did not quite know how to feel. And so I was grateful that they had voluntarily made that decision and given that gift, even in a really difficult time for them.
How difficult is the surgery from your standpoint, from a recipient's standpoint?
Well, it's been a year, and I still do eye drops every day, steroid drops. And so it's not difficult. I was awake for the procedure and had it done. And of course, they're amazing at the University of Iowa. And so they did some great surgery and great recovery time. The hardest part for me was because they attach it to your cornea or to your eye, you have to lay on your back and look at the ceiling for 48 hours. You can't move very much. And if anyone knows me, sitting on my back and looking at the ceiling, not being able to read, not being able to check my phone, not being able to watch TV was very hard for me and my two kids who were jumping all over me. So that was kind of a strange recovery. You have to make sure it sticks. So you have to lay horizontal. But it was pretty quick. And again, the drops, we just kept having to do drops. I go back to Iowa City again in January for another check. And then, of course, they check my other eye and they're monitoring that as well.
Did it make a difference for you after that 48 hours? Could you see the difference immediately?
No. And that was hard, too. That was frustrating because it was like you wanted that moment where you can just wake up in the morning and see clearly. And the two things that happened were it took a while for me to get my vision back. It's not as great as it was before, which sounds odd, but it is consistently great, or, you know, it's consistently good. And so I can count on it. And I know, I mean, it's 2015 or something like that. And I know what it's going to be. I know what to expect. It's the same at 6 in the morning or noon. And then the other hard part is that my other eye is still funky. So, you know, it's struggling a little bit to figure out what's going on with the other eye and how it fits in my eye. But overall, I think I definitely know that in the morning, I don't have the halos. When I close my left eye, sometimes I drive to work with only my new eye open. And, kind of see everything through the way things will be eventually. And that's kind of nice, too.
How often do you think about that woman?
Often. And often in times when I don't expect it. You know, there are times when I see something that my kids do or when I'm up late reading. And just last night, in fact, my daughter came in because she was scared about some recent events that have happened. And she wanted to talk about them. And I was able to look on the computer with her and look at some things and really kind of engage with her without thinking, can I see? You know, well, what does that say, honey? And I felt like I don't know. I guess I could act my age. I felt like I was really just acting like a 39-year-old instead of feeling like my eyes were those of a 65-year-old, which are fine, but I'm not 65. So I feel like I think of her a lot when I'm doing things that I know she would probably want to be doing. And I wonder who she is and where she's from. And I think of her family mostly and what they're missing.
What a tremendous gift.
Absolutely. It's a remarkable gift. And I'm certainly not a, you know, I'm not a big advocate for anything. I'm not trying to advance a cause. But certainly the gift that this person gave to me, which is minor compared to the gift that someone else has given for life or that maybe her organs gave someone else, is so important and gave some meaning to a really difficult time, I think, especially if she was 41. That's one of those times when there's a lot of why. And so I think that hopefully this gave them at least a little bit of, well, at least we can find some good.
Jennifer, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jennifer Confirst is the communications manager at Iowa Public Television. She received a cornea transplant just over a year ago. My first two guests today had their lives changed by strangers, but my next guest is here to talk about a person who is very close to her. Paige Younge is a graduate student at the University of Iowa. She grew up in Cedar Rapids. And Paige, your story starts when you were 7 years old. You were diagnosed with attention deficit disorder. What was going on in your life that led to that diagnosis?
It was actually my second grade teacher who noticed it, the typical signs, the distraction, the fidgeting, unable to meet a deadline, all of the classic DSMV criteria I met. And she was actually pretty progressive at the time and told my mom to have me tested because it was new. It had only been in the diagnosis manual for about 5 years at that point.
How did your parents respond when your teacher suggested that?
My mom jumped on it. She went, okay, if this is something that we can work with and get help for, we are absolutely going to figure this out. So we went down to St. Luke's and met with one of the doctors there who was working with attention deficit disorder and went through all of the tests, and they all came out. Every single positive one, they say if you meet, like, X percentage of them, you are. I met 100% of them.
So what happened next? How did you get treated?
They put me on Ritalin because that was the drug of choice at the time. And after that, my teacher noticed a big difference, and my mom started working with me with behavioral therapies, tactics and techniques and tricks to help keep me on track, help me finish tasks. That was always a big one. I could never finish anything, and I'd get distracted. And just those things to help me out, to build a routine, to help me, what's the word I'm looking for, to help me manage the disorder so that I could function more easily in everyday life.
So can you give me an example of some of the behavioral techniques that she helped you work on?
Mm-hmm. I still use them today, actually. My two favorites is one is finish your circle. And she actually sat me down, and she drew a circle on a piece of paper, and she left a gap in it. And I told her, I'm like, the circle is not finished. You have to finish it, because I'm a perfectionist. And she said, exactly. When you stop a task, you're not finishing your circle. You have to finish your circle. And to this day, even in the bakery, she will tell me, and I'll tell other people, you have to finish the circle. I have to finish my circle. And it simply means to get your task finished from step one to step finish. The other one that I really like is break it into manageable pieces, because it's very common for ADD children and adults to get very flustered when they have a whole slew of activities and parts to a test that need to be completed, and it gets chaotic, and that's when we just go, nope, not doing it, and walk away and go do something else that's fun. And she taught me how to literally break it into manageable pieces, break the test down, ignore everything that I'm not doing right now, and focus on that first piece. And that first piece done, the next piece comes up on the conveyor belt, and we work on that piece. And that has helped almost more than anything to clear the chaos out of my head and help me succeed when I put my mind to it to get something done.
So with the use of medication, with the use of these behavioral modifications, you were able to get through school
mm-hmm.
and college.
Mm-hmm.
You went to the Peace Corps.
Mm-hmm.
You're in graduate school now.
Mm-hmm.
And you feel that all of that was made possible by this work.
Absolutely. It absolutely was. Obviously, in her support, her just looking at me every day and saying, you can do this. We're going to get through this together. It's okay. That helped. But it was the behavioral therapies. The medicinal helped get me calmed down and focused enough that the behavioral aspect could come through. But without that side of it, I don't know how I would be, honestly. I don't know how my life would have turned out, but it would not have been as successful as it has been.
So until just recently, when you've talked to people about your ADD, you have told them that you got good medicinal support from physicians and you had a great therapist and your mom was very supportive. But tell me what you recently found out about that great therapist.
It was just a few weeks ago, actually. My mom and I were in the car, and I was telling her about talking to one of my teachers and about how my behavioral therapy suggested by a therapist have really helped. And she looked at me and she goes, there was no therapist. And I turned to her and I said, what do you mean there was no therapist? We went to St. Luke's and did behavioral therapy, right? She goes, no. Well, where did all that stuff come from, Mom? Where did all those techniques that I'm reading about in ADD books now, where did all those come from? She goes, I made them all up. And everything I came up with, she actually passed by her mother, who was working in social services as an admin assistant at the time, to get support on it to see what would work. And everything came from my mom. Not one thing came from a book or a therapist.
And at the time you were diagnosed, there probably wasn't a lot of behavioral modification.
There wasn't. That was the big thing, because it was so new. It's just, here's some medicine, and let's see what that does. It's only been since I was a child that they've done a lot of research to show that behavioral and medicinal therapies together is the best course of action. And like I said, I've seen therapists since then. I've gotten all of the books, of which there are plenty now. There were hardly any when I was a kid. And they're all telling me to do the exact same things that my mom has already told me, things that she came up with on her own.
Wow.
I know. I was shocked. I was gobsmacked, speechless, which for me is an oddity.
What did you say to her?
When I finally got over my picking my jaw up off the car floor, I said, I actually teared up. So I said, how did you do that? And she goes, well, it's what needed to be done to help you be successful. Well, I didn't have a choice. I'm your mom. It's what I do. And I looked at her, I just said, wow. And the only thing I could say was thank you. Because I mean, there were no words to describe what I was feeling at that, the gratitude and the love I was feeling at that moment.
What's your mom's name?
Julie Harden.
Well, that's a wonderful story, Paige. Thank you so much for sharing it with us today.
My pleasure.
Paige Younge is a graduate student at the University of Iowa. She talked with us from her mom's bakery, Jules Bakery, in Marion. The stories you're hearing today came to us from our listeners. We heard from a lot of people, and you'll get to hear more of these stories today on River to River with Ben Kiefer. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, I'm talking with people whose lives have been impacted in a powerful and positive way by someone else. And my next guest today is Lynn Salisbury of Iowa City. Lynn, thank you so much for being here today.
Great to be here.
Lynn, let's go back to 1988. You were in Stuttgart, Germany. What were you doing there?
I was visiting someone over the weekend. I was actually going to school for the semester in Copenhagen. So I went to see a friend and stayed.
And when you were in Stuttgart, there was an accident. What happened?
I was crossing the tracks at a station, and the trains take off very, very quickly. I was wanting to get from point A to point B as quickly as possible. Impetuously jumped off a 5-foot platform and looked both ways and kept looking as I crossed the bevy of tracks. And when I was either in front of or in between some cars, it took off very quickly and took me with it.
Oh, wow. How badly were you injured?
Well, I tried to get up and I thought, okay, I need to help myself. I went into the survival mode and I thought, all right, my legs are pretty hurt. I looked down and I saw that I was very likely that one of my legs was broken. And I don't have a visual memory of that anymore, thankfully. But I do remember thinking, I have to stay alert until I know someone is here to help me. And then I will give in to the nauseating pain that I'm feeling right now. Because I did hit my head and I was banged around quite a bit. And the train didn't stop immediately. I mean, it hit me and went for a little bit. So this kind soul came to my side and I said, okay, keep talking to me. What's your name? Thank you for being here. And she put her coat over me because she could see that I was kind of starting to go into shock. And I said, can you please stay with me until the ambulance gets here? And she did. And then I begged the ambulance drivers to let her come along with me. And ironically, she had been in an accident involving a subway like 2 years prior. So she did ride with me. But once I got into the ambulance, I do remember just giving in. And when I arrived, I'm told later that I was without visible any vital signs. And someone touched me somewhere, though, that it showed that there was still brain activity because I moved from pain. And they went ahead and they did the amputation of my right leg. They tried to stabilize my left leg, which had lost quite a bit of flesh. They had the closed head injury. They took out a piece of my skull to allow my brain to swell, which if they had not done that, I probably wouldn't be able to put thoughts and words together as well as I can now, thankfully, 20-some years later. And they just basically put me into a drug-induced coma to just slow everything down and did things in pieces after that in terms of, like, skin grafting. And they couldn't cast my left leg, that where the broken femur was, because of the skin loss. And when I was brought out of this coma and was trying to figure out, okay, where am I? What has happened? And my brain was not allowing me to acknowledge that I was even in Germany. I was convinced that I was still in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And at this time, I'm at Fairview Hospital. And my grandparents are only a mile from here. Why haven't they come to see me yet? So there was all this very strange trying to accept, I guess, where I was. And my brain was also telling me with nerve endings that my right leg was still there. And I could see part of it. I have half of a thigh. So my foot was falling asleep. I had what they call phantom pain. And I told myself, well, there's a hole in the bed and my leg is just bent and hanging down underneath, because I could actually feel my leg swinging around, the missing leg, kicking the bottom of the bed, trying to wake it up. It was very, very odd. There were a lot of funny moments, a lot of horrible moments.
Well, it's such a nightmare scenario. Here you are. How old were you?
21.
You were 21 years old, a world away from home.
Mm-hmm.
Horribly, horribly injured in the hospital. Once you started to understand what had happened to you, what was your mental state like? What were you thinking?
I was thinking, how am I going to go back to school this year? How am I going to carry on with my life? When will I be walking and running again? Just everything. How do I walk up the stairs? How do I, when we get home to my home in Minnesota, my bedroom's on the second floor, and they're telling me, well, you can't walk right now. You have to wait and repair things, and your femur still can't be cast. Well, you're not going to cast it. That was another thing. I didn't believe that my leg was broken because there wasn't a cast in my leg, and I'd swing my leg around, and they would, like, wince because I was swinging around a broken leg. But I couldn't feel it. My power of the mind was like, it's not broken. So getting back home or just – accepting little by little and what was going to – how my life was changed, and not changed just temporarily where you've got a cast and the leg will heal. There was all this, well, what can I still do? Will I still be able to ski? Will I still be able to ride a bike? You know, what's out there? And who is going to want to be with me through all of this? They – had shaved my long hair off my head to do the craniotomy. So I was bald and limbless and bandaged. And when my parents got to Germany, nearly three days after the accident, when I came out of the coma and was realizing more and more, I remember asking my mother, who is ever going to love me like this?
And while you were in the hospital, you got a telegram. Tell me about that telegram.
It was from a male peer of mine who we'd met as freshmen. And I will say that I was pleased with being able to just kind of play the field. And he was a little more interested in me initially. And I knew he was around. And he left St. Olaf and went to a different school. But I always kept in touch with him because he would come back and visit us right during finals week. And we kept in touch. We wrote letters. I knew he was lonely.
But he wasn't really a boyfriend before this happened.
No, not as strongly as – no, not before it happened. But, yeah, he did – I saw him, ironically, at the Boston airport where he was living when I went to Denmark. I had a layover, and I let him know, I'm going to be there for like 5 hours. Do you want to come and hang out with me at the airport? And he did, and he handed me a letter. And I thought, oh – I think I might know what this is going to say. And I just didn't open it. He's like, just, you know, open it on the plane sometime. And it was professing some pretty strong feelings. And I remember thinking, well, this is really lovely, but I'm 21. I'm not ready to think about, you know, really picking one person right now. I was having fun. So, but remember knowing that he was there, and also when he did send this telegram, which I received from people all over and was so supportive, his telegram has stood out to me over the years because it was from a male peer, and it said basically, no matter where you are, no matter what you become, I love you right now. And that was so moving, and so I just, it was a huge relief. It was a lovely, amazing gift. And I thought, well, he's always been a friend of mine. He always will be a friend of mine. I don't know who I'll end up with, but he will always be a very integral part of my life. So,
and he gave you that hope for the future at a yeah. time when you were thinking, what is there for someone who's just been through what I've been through?
Right.
So after you got out of the hospital, when did you see Mark?
So I saw him probably 6 weeks to 6 or 7 weeks after the accident. He came to see me at the Abbott Northwestern in Minneapolis. And that was, I remember my father meeting him at the door and giving him sort of a, well, just, you know, she might ask you things twice. Her short-term memory has been hit pretty hard. She may just bring up things that you're just unrelated to what you just said. Just be ready for that. And she looks a little different. And he was fine. I remember he gave me a kiss before he left, and that was so sweet. And just made me and empowering.
So where did your relationship go from there?
We kept in touch, and over the next year, I went back to school the following fall, and he came to visit several times. It was growing. It was budding to be more of like, yeah, I think he actually is my boyfriend now. I think I need to kind of acknowledge that. And we just made plans to, we were on the phone a lot. We made plans to see each other when we were going to be when he was going to be home visiting his parents in Minneapolis. And he moved actually back to Minneapolis from where he was living at the time when I moved there. And was taking some classes, and we continued to grow with, we're the right ones for each other. That's what we felt.
So you did get married.
Yes.
A few years later. And your health problems were not over. You had been through this horrific accident, but then as a very young woman, still in your 20s?
Yes.
You were diagnosed with breast cancer.
Yeah, it was the second year of our marriage. I was diagnosed with breast cancer that they were able to treat with lumpectomy and chemo and radiation. So it was 6 months of treatment. And then I was given a pretty good clean bill of health and regular checkups from that point on. Nothing else was really wrong. So we felt like we were in the clear until this past February, and right before Valentine's Day, and our oldest son's birthday is Valentine's Day, and we were going away for a weekend, and my parents were visiting, and I had this questionable report, and I just thought, I don't need to bring this up now. No one's calling me saying you need to check in. They just were telling me this is what we were finding. We'll do some more tests. And so I waited until after the holiday weekend to just contact the doctors and line things up and let my family know what was going on. And they said that the cancer had returned, same breast, and because of the radiation that I received in my 20s, I was no longer a candidate for radiation unless I wanted heart damage. They don't treat, if I presented to them now as a 20-something-year-old with the same cases, they would treat me totally differently, different meds and less radiation. So anyway, they kept me alive this long. So I guess it worked then, but it's given me some repercussions of other things. So the treatment now is like, well, you have to have your breast removed. And we're going to send your breast. And I thought this was kind of funny. They sent it off to some lab someplace warm. And I thought, so my breast is going on a trip and I'm not. Okay, that's not quite fair. But they tested the breast with everything that, to see what it would respond to chemically. And they said I wasn't a candidate for chemotherapy, which is, you know, it's great. But I thought, well, what is going to treat me other than just surgery? Because they're telling me that there's still this kind of fairy dust of cancer cells that are around the area where they remove the breast. And so now I'm on an oral medication for an unknown amount of time right now and watching with tests.
When you were in that hospital in Germany and Mark sent you that telegram, that was in some ways, I suppose, an impetuous act of a young man in love, but it was also an incredibly kind gesture when a lot of guys would have just disappeared. And once you're older and you get married, you're supposed to be together through thick and through thin and better and worse. But what makes Mark so special? You've been through a lot together.
He's still here, for one thing. I've thrown a lot of things his way. And he is still a pillar of support. And I never hear him complaining about anything that I've had that has made our life a little more difficult, a little more stressful, because he's juggling a lot of different things. Work and our children require different things for their ages. He's just always there and willing to give me what I and our family what we need to keep us together.
It strikes me that the two of you must share a similar sense of humor that has brought you through this as well.
I think so. Yes, we joked that during the breast cancer, we were going to come out with a shirt that, not the Got Milk shirt, but we were going to have one side that said whole milk and one side that said half. Because we knew we still wanted to have kids. So we thought, well, you know, I could wear that when I was pregnant or after having the baby. Because we didn't, of course, follow through with that. But there's just always little dark humor things that we have to throw in to get through the day. Or get through the moment when I was going through my first night of chemotherapy, that we joked the next morning about where we would start our story for the TV drama of the week and who would play us. And at that time, Mark looked very much like a character on this program, 90210. And so we joked about, you know, who would play me? And I was picking out some lovely brunette, brown-eyed young thing that I always wanted to look like. And we thought, well, how are we going to wrap this up? And my mother was there too. And so she said, well, who should play me? She was coming up with other actresses. And then we talked about where the story would start with the accident and the friendship and the romance and then the cancer. And my mom said, but how are we going to end this? And without, I don't know where this thought came from, but it popped out of my mouth. I said, we're going to end with you being the surrogate for our first child.
Oh, Lynn, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Pleasure.
Lynn Salisbury of Iowa City. You've been listening to stories today that were sent to us by our listeners. Stories about someone doing something, taking some action that impacted their lives in a powerful and positive way. We heard from so many people, and we didn't get to share all the stories on the air. So thank you for participating. If you did send us an email, you will get to hear more of these stories today on River to River with Ben Kiefer. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Sarah Bowden, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan with technical support from John Pemble. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Happy holidays. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.